Welcome to the Impact Equals podcast, in which we explore the impact investment industry, what it is, why it matters, and how it is playing a key role in reshaping how business is undertaken in many parts of the world. My name is Andrew Murray Watson. My guest today is someone who I'm going to imagine for a moment, before he probably corrects me, spends a great deal of time sitting on yachts, hanging out at huge country houses, going to exclusive black tie events, and generally getting up close and personal with some of the wealthiest people in the world. Tom Hall is the head of social impact and philanthropy at UBS, one of the largest investment banks in the world. He leads a social impact team of over 150 professionals across the globe to help clients and UBS employees to maximize their impact locally and globally. He has personally advised over 2,500 clients and their families during his time at UBS and is passionate about identifying scalable solutions to the pressing social and environmental problems the world is facing. A regular speaker at conferences around the world, Tom believes that through partnerships, we can build an impact economy that values people and planet in all investment decisions and builds a world that is profitable for all. Tom is something of a gamekeeper turned poacher, having spent the earlier part of his career as Director of Philanthropy and Social Investment at the disability charity Scope, where he pioneered the use of social investment structures, including the Scope Bond, which was the first listed bond issued by an operational charity in the UK. Tom also worked with the Cabinet Office on the development of the new social investment tax relief. Tom, great to have you with us. Did I get that right? Do you spend a lot of time hanging out with very wealthy clients, trying to persuade them to part with their money for good causes, or is that something of an oversimplification?
Well, I think actually what happens is because I spend time with lots of successful people who want to dedicate some of their resources to change the world, we end up in less salubrious settings. In fact, one of the clients I was with in Vietnam, I think it was the worst hotel he'd ever stayed in his life. And it was probably one of the best experiences he'd ever had. So I'd like to think that that we challenge each other and
tell us, in our pursuit. In more serious note, I mean, tell us, break down what your role entails.
Yeah, so ultimately, I'm in the lead for UBS's strategy around social impact and philanthropy, which at one level is a client service. We know that 95% of our clients want to use their resources to try and have impact on the pressing social and environmental problems the world's facing. And equally, we're also using UBS's own capital in terms of what impact can we achieve in the communities in which, you know, we have our presence, our employees, and we're bringing the two together to try and leverage our impact. So that's our mandate. As you said before, you know, I've had the privilege of advising thousands of clients personally, but it's not just me, it's my global team. And we'd spend our time really just trying to do that, trying to support our clients to maximize their impact in the way that they deploy their capital, starting with philanthropy, but obviously segueing into how they invest their other resources and indeed how they use their operating businesses, because that's a huge area where people can have an impact footprint and really just try and become that trusted impact advisor to these families who really do genuinely have the resources to
And what does that conversation look like? I mean, is it generally people coming to you and saying, help us, or are you going to them and saying, have you thought about social impact and philanthropy? I mean, what's the sort of the structure of the conversation look like?
Somebody said to me the other day something which I thought was kind of amusing, which is, you met one family office, you've met one family office, right? There's a huge amount of fragmentation. And I think, you know, by and large, people will come from all sorts of different spaces. You know, the amusing ones, the ones who say, how do I get a knighthood? less common, to be honest, much less common, but it definitely happens. By and large, a lot of people are genuinely motivated. I mean, there's been a huge entrepreneurial wealth creation in the last 20 years, right? The global value of billionaires has gone from 1 trillion to almost 8 trillion in the last 10 years. And these are individuals who are, you know, often more successful than they expected to be. They definitely didn't grow up with those resources, and they don't necessarily want to give them all to their kids because they don't want to necessarily kind of impact their own sense of self-determination. And I think, you know, nothing kills motivation than not having to get out of bed, right? So I think that desire to get wealth transfer right, it means philanthropy is a logical consequence. So often there's kind of this not even well articulated sense of, yeah, it's not all for my kids, so then what is it for? I definitely don't want the tax man to take it all in inheritance tax. So maybe I'll get started with philanthropy. And sometimes it's as simple as that. People haven't even got there. At other times, they are already absolutely in love with a particular particular charity or you know, silver bullet solution that they think is going to be scaled and change the world. And they want us to tell our other clients about how amazing that opportunity is. And we have to navigate that journey as well. So really, you know, we have these multiple different starting points. But I think ultimately what we try and quickly get to is that, that not all philanthropy is good and effective. You can definitely cause harm with poorly implemented philanthropy. And the only way to avoid that is to measure your impact. And once you start measuring your impact, which we define not as kind of inputs, how much you're investing, or your outputs, how much you're you know, delivering in terms of the number of schools you build, for example, but outcomes, are kids really learning? Are lives really being saved? And then you start to get into the kind of science of outcome measurement. What's your cost per outcome? Then it, you know, again, because so many of our clients come from a business background, they start to get really into the idea of, well, I want to maximize the number of outcomes I can get for the amount of capital I'm deploying, and what's the most efficient way to deploy that capital, and how do I measure it, and how do I scale it? So then you're naturally already quite quickly into a territory which, you know, having said it's all one family office is one family office, actually I do think there's a commonality across all these family offices and individual wealthy individuals, is that, you know, they do want to see the biggest bang for their buck. And that's ultimately what we try and offer them with our services, you know, from an advice perspective right through to actual philanthropic investment opportunities, segueing into mainstream investment opportunities that can really drive measurable impact to scale.
So how does that separate between pure philanthropy and more kind of impact investment? I mean, is it, you talked about your clients looking to maximize the impact they're having. I mean, are they expecting some sort of financial return, or is it purely philanthropic?
Well, I mean, if every family has different pools of capital, right? So, you know, how much ends up in the philanthropy bucket is still a little bit unknown. Forbes estimated that it could be as much as 10 trillion by the mid-2030s, bearing in mind it's 2 trillion today. That's a pretty big growth, right? And obviously, that's money that could be given away over a period of time, or it could be invested and the income from it is given away. But that money is primarily, or it ought to be primarily, in pursuit of impact outcomes, really high quality, proven causal impact. And I, you know, we argue that the best standard of evidence for impact is when you have a control. So like when you're bringing a new drug or vaccine to market, you absolutely know its efficacy. You wouldn't give your child a medicine that hadn't been through a clinical trial because you wouldn't trust it, right? That's true in the healthcare industry, but in other sectors, we don't have that standard of evidence. For example, in education, we often implement new pedagogies without really any testing at all. So our argument is, you know, philanthropic capital is pursuing really high quality impact outcomes with really good data. That's what it should do. And then the question is, then how do you scale that? Now, fundamentally, you cannot scale that with philanthropy because there's not enough money, right? There's, if you use the Sustainable Development Goals as a proxy, we would need $30 trillion by 2030 in order to sustainably meet the funding needs to address these Sustainable Development Goals. So if philanthropy tries to do that by giving itself away, i.e. you try and give people a free education globally or provide healthcare globally, then that $10 trillion would run out very, very quickly. There's simply not enough capital, right? So even philanthropists, when they're approaching their giving, should be thinking about scale. And actually, scale is really only going to come in one of two stroke three ways. You know, one is, can you create more efficient, more measurable, profitable ways of driving impact? So, you know, an example that we've invested in is things like low-cost private schools. We know some families do choose to send their kids to private school, and that's a choice that I think should be available to people. Obviously, we want the public school systems to be good as well. But if they are sending their kids to these low-cost private schools, they should be high quality. There's good ones, there's bad ones. But inherent in that business model is that if they're successful, they generate revenue, and that revenue can ultimately repay the cost of upfront financing. So, you know, we incubated a low-cost private school model called Rising Academies back in 2015 and helped them do their first randomized control trial, proving that their pedagogy could actually improve learning outcomes at, you know, about 2x compared to the control. So kids were learning twice as much. And then over the last almost decade now, they've scaled up initially with a low-cost private school model, but also now they've done a public-private partnership in Liberia, and they're part of an outcomes contract where it's actually a pay for results mechanism, which in fact we are co-investing together in a $100 million fund that we raised alongside Bridges Ventures to invest in outcomes contracts where they're actually being paid for the children to learn. And that's one of those classic examples where you start with philanthropy and you deliberately design it to start to become investable. And in that example, that's now being invested in by families who have incubated it with philanthropy, but now they're investing in it with some of their different pots. So let's say they've got a pension fund, which you can't lose. It's got to deliver from a fiduciary risk perspective, a market risk adjusted return. So in order for them to invest in it, you have to create the financial instruments that actually allow them to adjudge that it is the right risk return and impact for that pot of capital. So ultimately, I think the way that we think about it is, how do we design investment opportunities across that spectrum of capital, from philanthropy all the way through to, you know, risk assets, through to the absolute don't lose it money, that have some kind of impact overlay? Because, you know, ultimately, if we can drive capital at scale into things that measurably prove impact, that's the holy grail, isn't it? You know, if we can recycle that capital and make returns on it, then that's the, you know, the ultimate outcome, and that's how we square this circle of, you know, funding the $30 trillion funding gap.
I mean, it's a really interesting point where you said about recycling capital. Do you think that the importance of doing that is recognized as widely as it should be amongst the kind of development community?
Yes and no. You know, I'd like to say, you know, the impact economy, obviously not my term, and Ronnie Cohen, I think, was one of the first to use it almost 12 years ago. It's both being built and needs to continue to be built, right? And part of this is a battle for ideas, a battle for how we use resources. And I still see sometimes that people come up with concepts that just simply aren't scalable, right? You know, let's invest in a school feeding program in an African country. Great, the outcomes are really solid, but unless you've got some kind of exit strategy, you know, for example, sustainable government adoption, that is just not, you're not going to sustain that across an entire country, because you would need something like $600 million a year. And there's almost no nonprofits that are that kind of size, right? So actually, you know, we really encourage our clients to think about what is the, you know, the sustainable exit strategy for any deployment of capital, even really at the early stage, because what can often happen is people get excited, they get passionate about something they set up, and then they realize the business model is flawed and they're kind of stuck with it. So I think it, you know, it's something that we keep talking about when we're advising our clients, is, you know, just really think with kind of that end in mind as to, you know, how are you going to sustain the impact? Because the worst possible thing that can happen, in our view, is that you start doing something, you start helping, you know, a percentage of people, and then you have to row back and you have to withdraw services. And I've seen that happen a number of times now in my career, where people have got, they've got excited and want an idea to work, but they haven't really thought through the scaling pathway.
Sure. So, I mean, what if you, I don't know if there's such a thing as the typical client in your world, but I mean, if a client comes to you and they've got $10 billion, what sort of number, what sort of percentage do they typically look to kind of put into philanthropy, for example? I mean, is it, what sort of range are you generally seeing? Because I guess it's quite an important question, given that there's a context now of talking about a global billionaire tax and all the money that would raise to go towards climate finance, for example. I mean, you're talking to these people all the time. Are they in effect already devoting a certain amount of capital to things like climate finance and philanthropic causes?
So I would say, and it's somewhat anecdotally, because obviously people are still, they're still often running their operating businesses, made these resources in the first place, and that is time consuming. We've seen through things like the Giving Pledge, you know, I would say early indications and then activations of significant, like 90% of resources. I mean, you know, we had an event actually at the Vatican about 18 months ago where Jeff Bezos spoke, and it was kind of really interesting talk about his background. And he, you know, his father was an illiterate Cuban migrant, and if it hadn't been for the free education he'd got, Jeff wouldn't be where he was today, which I thought was really interesting. The next week he announced that he was going to give away most of his $178 billion, right? Now, and he's already activated $10 billion, I think, through into the Bezos Earth Fund. So you know, we are seeing that happen. We're seeing momentum. I still think there's a huge amount of latent non-decision making in this, i.e. Mm-hmm. people kind of recognize that they're probably going to, and look, the answer is anything from very rarely zero all the way through to literally 90 to 95% of the resources, yeah. particularly the billionaire end. But it's kind of still somewhat undecided as to exactly which entity, how it will be controlled. A very interesting family I was working with recently, actually settled a lot of their resources into a donor advised fund, which is not even their own foundation. It's a more efficient vehicle for managing philanthropic capital. And it's going to be run by a professional CEO. It's not even the family controlling it, which I thought was really interesting. It's got a very clear mandate. And that, again, is around conservation and climate. So I think broadly, yes, that is happening. But even if you add that all up, it's still not sufficient if the strategy is giving. And this is the critical point, right? We have to bring together this kind of precious risk capital of philanthropy, which if used correctly, can do multiple things. Like it can innovate and find what we like to call the impact unicorns of the future, businesses, social enterprise that can measurably have impact in the billions. But then it needs to help finance them. It needs to help de-risk investing in them from the main investing, industry, particularly in emerging markets, in order to get to the kind of scale that's required. And I think that also requires partnerships with governments as well, because they're, absolutely critical to the scaling pathway for impact enterprises, either from a regulatory perspective or from a direct commissioning or paying for services. And I think that that's the recognition that perhaps is still something that we need to continue to point to examples of where that's happening, so people can get inspired about how really working in partnership to build an impact economy and a system that sustainably ensures that people are able to survive and thrive in life.
Is there, for want of a better expression, enough bankable projects? I mean, do we have a situation where capital supply is sufficient if there were more projects in which to invest? I mean, what's the sort of the supply demand equation look like?
So I think that's a fascinating question, because it kind of really gets to the heart of one of the issues, which is what do we mean by bankable? Because if your comparator is a developed market investment opportunity, well, let's say even in technology, and that's going to give you a 25-30% target, IRR, going to get four times money multiple in a private equity investment over 10 years time. Do you have equivalence in emerging markets where you've got to also hedge against inflation and deal with, let's be honest, other political risks and, other real issues around, risk? No, that I don't see that you can directly compare those two things as easily. Are there, on the other hand, what I would describe as real-world economy businesses that are sustainable, that are having impact, that could be invested in rather than be granted to, but are currently not getting access to capital because they aren't able to benchmark themselves in a meaningful or scalable way against mainstream financing? Yes, and let me just give you one tangible example. Right, we were looking to invest in an oxygen business in Kenya, supplying medical oxygen for the whole of East Africa about 3 years ago. And it was a viable business. It was able to pay a 9% dollar return on its equity or debt. You could structure it in either way. And it just couldn't get financing because the market was saying that the price to invest in that business should be 26, because that was the perceived and or real risk. And maybe it is a combination of both. But because we had philanthropic capital that was, essentially willing to be given away, we structured a blended finance instrument where that took a first loss position, meaning that we could actually lend to that business at the 9% hurdle rate. And now a million more babies are getting access to medical oxygen across East Africa. And in fact, they were also supplying oxygen during COVID. And we see lots of examples like that where, I'd almost call it, you could call it market failure. You could just call it, the real issues around what's happening in the economy. But this is where I think philanthropy working in partnership with investment capital and indeed with development finance institutions like BII can actually start to build up a track record for these kinds of real world economy businesses. And ultimately over a 5, 10, 15 year period, if you can actually invest at sufficient scale in things like health and education in particular, and you can allow allow human capital to develop and fulfill its potential, those economies will grow. And some of these risks are, some of these geopolitical risks and some of the, other issues which cause these pricing inefficiencies, hopefully will start to ameliorate. So, so actually, it's an interim solution to use philanthropic capital to, some people say subsidize. I like to say catalyze investment opportunities in emerging markets. But I think that that is something that is, a hugely powerful tool. And there are indeed opportunities in that kind of space, and some people call it the missing middle of capital. Obviously, the holy grail is that, you build up that track record, that oxygen business, because it's received proper financing, it's paid its returns, it's scaling and growing. It can then go into, let's say, an emerging market, private equity fund that doesn't have any, blended support in it in the future, right? So you're trying to create a pathway to ultimately make it be able to benchmark with the developed market fund in time, but we have to step our way there.
Yeah, where are the major gaps in that pipeline? Is it at the start of the process with where philanthropic capital comes in? I mean, is it sort of where's the missing pieces in the jigsaw puzzle to really kind of turbocharge that kind of pipeline opportunity?
I would say that to be honest, it is across the whole spectrum. So we need to find more innovations that genuinely measure their impact, that have the business model for scale. So the search for impact unicorns, setting up accelerators, we're partnering with the London School of Economics on the 100X accelerator, which is looking at trying to find 20 similar ventures that are actually already at similar size. They've already proven their model if they're B2G or B2C. They're on the cusp of genuine scale, but they need further support and incubation and maybe the redesign of their business model to really take it to the next level. So that's still needed. But then I think what's also needed is more flexible financing, more people who can make a risk return and impact decision, which is, able to compare, a private equity fund investment that has no impact associated with it and pays a 20% return with one that has a really deep impact associated and only pays 9 or 10, and choose the 9 or 10 because that's what they want from their capital. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think also within the industry, we need to get better at trying to build product that serves the different needs. And, I just was recently on, in fact, two calls just this week with two major foundations looking to invest several hundred million that wanted that total impact approach. They literally, they want to be able to make a call between, the deeper impact where it's more causal and therefore more risky, potentially, particularly in the emerging markets, but offset that with perhaps slightly safer, higher yielding investments in developed markets and make their own ultimate, risk return and impact decisions. And I think sometimes in the industry, and this is totally understandable, because it's highly regulated, we often make decisions on behalf of our clients because we want to judge the risk and return for them. And therefore, and impact is very hard to measure and it's very hard to compare apples with oranges. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges as well, is there is no standardization of impact measurement, right? So, in the bond industry, you offer a bond fund, there's three major houses that basically use a similar system to give a bond rating and therefore a proxy for the risk. In the impact industry, we've got highly fragmented, lots of small houses, basically all coming up with their own proprietary methodologies. And it's quite hard for investors to then be able to make those decisions, or even not even investors, but intermediaries and banks to be able to, sort out which ones even ought to be put in front of their clients to help them make those decisions.
Well, I think you've sort of more or less preempted my next question in terms of what impact equals for your for UBS and for your clients, because as you just said, there is no unified measurement tool to measure impact. I mean, how do you sort of navigate those waters?
Well, so for us, we've been advising our clients on how to apply, impact rating methodologies to their own philanthropy or investing for years. And what we've started to do is work across the industry just to what we don't want to be an impact rating tool. We don't want to try and sell those services because we think there's too many proprietary tools out there trying to do that. What we do think is required is a degree of standardization, right? All the tools should use a similar series of methodologies. There's been the Impact Management Project, which was, I think, was a good start. There's been some other good pieces of work, but we still think there's some work to be done so that it's really easy and simple to understand for the average investor. And if you were to kind of compartmentalize it, I think there's three things that you really need to know when you're making an investment that you hope gets impact alongside, you know, risk-adjusted return. One is, ultimately, like, what's the evidence of the impact, right? What's the standard? And I think too often we go, yes, it's an impact investment and, you know, X, Y, Z has happened. But what we're not saying is, okay, was that self-reported data? Was that baseline and endline data? Or was it, in our view, the highest standard of data where you've proven out causality, like in the pharmaceutical industry? We know A causes B. So that's a critical component. We then obviously need to know, what is the depth and breadth of that impact? Because you can have causality, but not do very much of it, or not to very many people. So, and also not to where it's most needed in terms of areas of disadvantage. So, and again, and this isn't to judge, but of the $1 trillion impact investing industry today, the vast majority of those investments are in developed markets, not in emerging markets, where perhaps you could argue we really need to drive capital. So we need to have a sense of, okay, yes, it's impactful to help people in more affluent societies, but actually the deeper impact where we were going to really move the needle for the global economy is helping the 600 million people who currently aren't even properly educated to get the education they need to be able to thrive economically, right? So measuring that piece is critical. And then sustainability and scale. And then wrapping all of that up in, you know, how much does my individual additional contribution move the needle, as opposed to, am I buying and owning something that's impactful? There's obviously a different qualitative level to the type of instrument. And that, we think, could be summarized into something as simple as a AAA rating. So, for example, the SDG Outcomes Fund I mentioned that we co-invested in together with BII, I would say that's as close as you're going to get to AAA in terms of the causality of impact, the depth of impact on inequality, some of the poorest communities you can visit being investable, and then the potential scale. You know, you could argue on that one in that it's actually only scalable if we really fix the way in which public money is spent. So that particular, you know, fund was investing in outcomes contracts, so pay for success mechanisms. We think there's a huge potential for scale for pay for success mechanisms, because essentially you're talking about public money being spent in a more transparent way, where you're actually paying for verified results in the context of one of the contracts in Ghana. That's KPMG doing an audit, right? You don't get paid unless KPMG have independently audited whether kids are learning. You know, we think that there's a huge opportunity to scale that into the trillions, but that also requires, you know, political will. And it requires, you know, more demonstration of projects. It requires, you know, countries like Australia have just announced, you know, hundreds of millions to start spending on outcomes, but they had to hire the civil servants to implement these policies, right? So this is not straightforward, but it is, you know, an example of something that again, in a functioning impact economy, these are the kinds of things we'd love to see at substantive scale. But we need to work our way towards arriving there. In the interim, there's maybe other really great investments. They're not going to be AAA, but they're still worth doing. And I think one of the challenges that I see in the whole rating industry, and particularly in financial services, is this risk of impact hushing. Because what you can bring to your clients at the moment, and hand on heart from a regulatory perspective, you know, it's too risky to do something that's really innovative and tricky to from an investment perspective. So what you bring is, I don't know, a triple C rated product, to use that analogy. You get punished because it's not better. But actually, instead of that, we should be celebrating when people are trying to bring, you know, rated impact product to their clients, even if it's not the best in class. Because the only way we get to best in class is we build the industry.
So, should there be a Moody's then for impact, essentially?
Yeah, exactly. I think there should. But what I think is interesting in the to use that analogy, of course, you've got Moody's and Standard & Poor's and others, is they're all using very similar underlying categories, and it all ultimately aggregates into the same rating system, like, you know, AAA or, you know, BBB or, you know, whatever it is, right? And that's, I think, what's needed, is this kind of standardization. Okay, so whether it's Moody's who do it, or Standard & Poor's will do it, or whomever else who does your impact rating, they're essentially applying a very similar methodology, and it arrives to the same kind of understandable and therefore market comparable piece of data. And that's currently missing in the industry.
Well, maybe somebody will listen to this and set it up. Who knows? Before we wrap up, we want to explore what your view is on in terms of the biggest impact trends that are going to emerge over this year and the next couple of years. So, I mean, if you had to sort of summarize those kind of emerging trends in three separate things, what would they be?
So one of the core impact trends that we've been working on is the need for collective impact. So, you know, actually starting that individual philanthropy lens, you know, if there's 10 trillion in philanthropy, but it's all dissipated across what I think, there's a million nonprofits in the US alone, I believe. So, you know, you can easily see that the lots of small scale may be impactful at a micro level, but because they're not ultimately scaling and not going to solve big social and environmental issues. So for a long time, we've been working on collective approaches to really encouraging people thematically. So for example, we've got a group of 20 clients who are pooling their resources into a climate collective where we've focused on nature-based solutions and how do we create business models around helping mangrove farmers, for example, not deforest their precious, you know, one of their 3 acres of mangrove to sell it for firewood because their family needs to eat, but find a sustainable business that rewards them for the avoided deforestation as well as, you know, sustainable aquaculture. So really getting people to come into those kind of collective approaches, I think, is critical. The second is this use of capital. So as I said before, you know, really thinking about using the philanthropic capital, not just at the grant end, because that's obviously an important role for the innovation space, but also to de-risk allowing real investment money to flow at scale into places where it wouldn't have flowed otherwise, make the uninvestable investable. And then finally, I think, you know, it's the conversation we just had. I think the trend is we have to invest in and actually by having collective partnerships, standardize how we measure and report on what we all mean by impact so that we can compare apples with bananas.
Yeah. Tom, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating hearing your insights into the world of philanthropy and impact investment. And to our listeners, thank you for joining and tune in next time.